Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. It's as old as Plato and as recent as the last local school board to ban the Harry Potter novels. It's called Protecting Our Children. And tonight we'll be asking how this is to be done, who's to do it, to what purpose the efforts should be made, and what unanticipated consequences may flow from those efforts. And maybe also, should we, through law and legislation, even try? In the words of the cereal commercial, what's a mother to do? And in today's real world, a father too. Our participants are uniquely qualified for this discussion. They are the Dean of the Boston University School of Law, Ronald Cass, whose special expertise includes the First Amendment, press issues, and communications law. Marjorie Hines of the National Coalition Against Censorship, author of Not in Front of the Children, Indecency, Censorship, and the Innocence of Youth. And attorney Harvey Silverglade of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, also co-author of The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on the Nation's Campuses. Thank you all for joining me.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Great to be back in Boston.
Now, the first question our listeners heard was, indecency and the innocence of youth. Can cracking down on one preserve the other? And innocent as the question may seem, there is really a lot all wrapped up in there. What's indecency? What's innocence? How youthful is youth? Why do youth need to be protected? And where did we get these notions? Let's go back to the beginning. Have we always had these concerns? And who's we? Western Europeans? People in general? Anglo-Saxons? Americans? When and where does this idea begin? And who here wants to begin?
Well, you're looking at me, Ted. All the questions you've asked were questions I asked myself during the 90s when I was working at the National American Civil Liberties Union as a First Amendment lawyer. And repeatedly, when we had a censorship case, whether it was a local school library removing a book or whether it was Congress passing the Communications Decency Act, essentially criminalizing indecent communications on the Internet, the response, the justification that we heard was, well, the First Amendment doesn't really apply here because it's all about protecting the kids. And just as you say, protecting the kids from what? What do we mean by innocence? What about youthful curiosity and intellectual freedom and getting education and information? And how do we define indecency anyway? And is it harmful? So I became sufficiently curious about these questions that eventually I set out to do some research. And the book that's resulted is really intended as a resource for people.
But where did it come from? Where did it actually begin? I think Plato had something to say about it, and Socrates actually took hemlock, didn't he, because he was accused of corrupting the morals of youth by things that he said.
Right. So it goes way back. And actually, I got interested in the Plato connection because Plato was actually quoted in a case, a school censorship case out of North Carolina. And, of course, Plato was a very great philosopher, but he was also rather totalitarian in his inclinations. And especially when it came to youth, he advocated very rigid censorship. And our notions of democracy and intellectual freedom are really diametrically opposed to the ideas in Plato's Republic. And so it was ironic that judges were now quoting him.
You do have a real problem here in that kids are very impressionable. They pick up on all sorts of things. The reason why they learn so fast is because they do pick up on things very quickly, and they can be influenced by a lot of what they see and hear. In today's world, that includes a lot of things, a lot of lyrics, a lot of visuals that I think most parents don't feel very comfortable with at all.
But tell me, that's a very American notion, though, that parents don't feel comfortable with their children learning about, particularly we're talking about sex, let's face it, because kids are exposed to violence and they're exposed to commercials for every useless product in the world. So we're really talking here about an American aversion to sex and particularly to children learning there is such a thing.
I agree and disagree with both of you. It's true in America, and it's even more true when you take a global view, that although protecting the kids or censoring the kids and directing their socialization is a very common concern, almost a universal impulse in all kinds of societies. There is no objective standard for what it is that they are supposed to be shielded from. And as Harvey suggested, some parents may be concerned about pornography. Some parents may be concerned about any sexual information. Some may be concerned about four-letter words, others really not. Some are concerned about violence, but very different ideas. Is it violent cartoons? Is it the news? Is it Saving Private Ryan? And but what we're really talking about is different cultural values.
But doesn't every culture have a certain body of values that it wants to transmit from one generation to another? I mean, isn't that part of having a culture?
Yeah, but in this culture, there's also respect for dissenting and minority values. But that's what freedom of expression is that.
Dean, Marjorie, Harvey, maybe this is a good time to read the quotation from Plato that was quoted in the appeals court decision of which you spoke earlier. A young person cannot judge what is allegorical and what is literal. Anything that he receives into his mind at that age is likely to become indelible and unalterable. And therefore, it is most important that the tales which the young first hear should be models of virtuous thoughts.
Well, it's nonsense, and of course, only the Supreme Court would believe it, and to tell you the truth, I doubt they really believe it. I think they feel it's obligatory to say it.
I'm not sure it's nonsense, but it's only half the picture, and it's a very reductive view of what art and entertainment and expression does. It doesn't only do a kind of propagandistic, unilateral message to people. It is much more ambiguous, and people's responses tend to vary. And kids are not, as the Supreme Court once said, in fact, only closed-circuit recipients of what the state chooses to communicate. Now, that doesn't mean the state doesn't have a role in educating. And that's where I'd agree with Dean Kass. There are concerns about the Internet. There are concerns about hate speech accessible to kids. Different people have different concerns, but...
But let's stay at for the moment with what Plato appears to be saying here, which is that the things that you read to your child are going to have a tremendous impact on him. I recall reading bedtime stories, which the wilder and the bloodier they were, the better. There was a book of Russian fairy tales, which go far beyond Grimm in presenting unusual situations that really, and my children loved them. They didn't seem to be swayed by them. They didn't have nightmares at night, but they did love the giants and the ogres and the witches. And I would think that by this standard, Plato would think I was harming the child.
For the courts to believe, or for Plato to believe, or for anybody to believe, that you have a child read something that the parent might think is immoral or unpleasant, and that child, that is going to sort of determine the child's attitudes, this is simplistic beyond belief. And the real question it seems to me we're facing is this. Given the fact, and I agree with Dean Kass, that we as a society transmit values, are we going to transmit values by withholding from young children the other side or the context or the rest of the information or competing values? Is that the way we're going to, in a free society, teach children, or are we going to let them take it all in and hope that we can help it put it into a context for them?
I worry about the letting them take it all in approach. That doesn't move me to saying for other people's children I know what to do. I think anyone who has tried to direct a child to do something you want them to do recognizes quickly how difficult it is to figure out what motivates children, what makes them do what we want, how they learn. There are two different things going on. One is the question, is there a problem? Are there issues that are of legitimate subjects of concern? The other is, if there is, what do you do about it? And the what do you do about it gets us into the question of how many different sorts of values are there, how many different views are there, what is it that the government properly can do? Before we get to that side, where I have a great deal of trouble finding things that the government usefully can do that don't raise more problems than they solve, I don't want to start by saying, well, there really isn't a problem to begin with, that it's just a few people who are concerned and they shouldn't be concerned and we have a peculiar American notion. We do have values we hold dear, and we ought to be concerned with changes in that. We ought not to immediately say, we see a change, let's stop it. We see a change, the government ought to police it. But it's legitimate to say there are problems we should be concerned about.
Well, I agree with you.
Should the government be saying what?
Right. The media has effects. And we should be worried about what kids are taking in. But the kinds of censorship reactions we get, whether it's the indecency law or the V-chip or the internet filter, is a symbolic reaction only, and it does not really advance the common interest educating kids.
It might help to ask what kind of ideas have traditionally been banned.
Well, in our Anglo-American culture, as Harvey says, it certainly has been the sexual.
It's all sexual.
But it has been primarily sexual, at least starting in about the 18th or 19th century.
Apparently, the idea of the innocence of youth is only about 150 or 200 years old. Prior to that, they were regarded as little miniature adults to be socialized, to be tamed. And because of the living arrangements, they were pretty clear on everything by the time they were 7 or 8 years old.
Well, first of all, it's only been relatively recent that youth has lasted into the early 20s. It used to be, kids, as Marge's book points out, were married by 12. This was when the average lifespan was 30. But now childhood seems to have gone right through to 20 or 21.
And for some of us, beyond that.
25.
Some of us try, Dean, but don't succeed.
I'm Ted O'Brien. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. And you're listening to a conversation that includes Boston University Dean of Law, Ronald Cass, Marjorie Hines, the author of Not in Front of the Children, Indecency, Censorship, and the Innocence of Youth, and Harvey Silverglate, whose book is called The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses. And we're discussing the issue of innocence and youth and indecency. Well, all right, let's get specific. There is so much coming in now over which we have no control. I talked with one mother who said, look, if they sent pornographic magazines to my home, I could do something about it. But with the internet, there are scores of sites there that she'd prefer that her 10-year-old, 12-year-old, 8-year-old not see.
It's very difficult. I mean, obviously, parents are the primary censors of their children, and they should be, and not the government, because parents do have very different values. And for a young child, that's relatively manageable. When the child starts getting older, the parent can't exercise absolute control. And a lot of information is out there. It's true. A lot of private companies and some of our political leaders have taken advantage of these anxieties on the part of parents by marketing such things as internet filters, the V-chip, TV ratings, and so forth. And parents ought to know about some of the over-blocking tendencies of these filters. They block out lots and lots of valuable stuff, for which reason they are really inappropriate for schools and libraries. They are not foolproof in terms of blocking what the parent thinks his or her particular child should not be exposed to. In fact, as Wendy Kaminer said in a column last week, buying an internet filter is like choosing 10 people at random off the subway and delegating to them the responsibility for directing your child's upbringing.
In the email program I have at the university, there are little chili peppers that appear to warn me of material that may be offensive, and I received by email the other day a memorandum that went to a number of people about some building and ground issues. And I was trying to figure out what was the problem with this memo. It was your standard bureaucratic memo. And I don't think they use the chili peppers to indicate it's going to put you to sleep. I finally discovered there were two people who were receiving the memo whose first name was Dick. And that was that had come into the filter. It's very hard to design filters that do what you want them to do. And that, of course, is part of the reason why so many people are concerned about a medium like the internet. They can't figure out how to describe what they want to block. They can't simply turn it over to somebody else and say, here, you describe what it is, because they can't trust the result. And they're sure that without it, the children will have access to a lot of stuff they don't want them to. Parents tend to be less good at controlling the computer than the child does.
There's also a certain amount of absurdity. For years, I represented the late poet Allen Ginsberg in an attempt to get the FCC rule changed, because under the FCC indecency rules, his poetry could not be read on the radio during the day because the kiddies would be awake and their ears would tingle. So you could only read it at night when the kids were presumed to be asleep. And there was this ironic situation where during the Cold War, when Eastern European was communist, his poetry was freely read in many communist countries, including Czechoslovakia and Poland, for example, and it couldn't be read here, which is what caused us to litigate. We litigated for like 10 years, and we managed to get the time slot changed, but we could not abolish the general rule that, quote, indecent poetry, close quote, couldn't be read during the day. Meanwhile, it's that his poetry is in some curricula in public schools. So there's a certain sense of the absurd in the FCC rules.
Harvey Silverglate, that's an example of child censorship in radio, the open media. And the argument as a broadcaster that I always heard was those are the public airwaves, and they are for the use and necessity of the public, and they therefore can be regulated. FCC Communications Act of 1934, which also said some things like you can only own seven stations, which have since gone by the board. But the reality was I could accept that in a way that publishing material, publications, for example, print, commercial media, I could see the difference there because of the means of dissemination by radio and subsequently television, by the fact that you owned a license to it because it was the public's medium.
But you're still giving the government an awesome power to decide. And just as an example, the Federal Communications Commission's most recent indecency ruling was against a radio station that played a feminist rap song called Your Revolution. And it starts, "Your revolution will not happen between my thighs." And it's all about sexual politics. And it's a woman's perspective telling macho male posturing revolutionaries, start having some respect for women. And because it had sexual content, the FCC has banned it from the airwaves. When the FCC decides to censor something because it's indecent, it's driven by politics. The last thing on their minds is whether kids are going to be harmed by hearing a feminist rap with sexual connotations. Now, that's a kind of political censorship that we should not want the federal government to be engaging in.
Well, what about the Pacifica case, the seven deadly words, the George Carlin record?
Deadly and dirty.
Well, remember, that was a parody. That was actually a brilliant, brilliant parody. Anybody who's bought it on record, a CD, I think would understand that it was a brilliant parody, and we couldn't listen to it on radio because it had seven dirty words. Now, this is a free country.
There was a warning before the program began and a warning during it that you might hear things that, you know, you wouldn't ordinarily hear. Out of an East Coast audience of possibly 40 million people, one person driving in a car made a complaint that his young child had heard those words against his will.
He also said this was an 11-year-old boy in the car with him.
It was a
15-year-old. I think he was. He said that he had listened to the entire monologue, mm-hmm. which lasted. I can't remember exactly how long, but it was at least 5 or 6 minutes long. But I'm not sure that I would accept, Ted, the point you made that radio and broadcasting really are different. We have had that in the law. The Supreme Court has accepted it. I'm not sure any of the differences articulated really hold up. We do try to be sensitive to context in the law, but if you ask how easy is it to get a hold of things, how easy is it to find what you're looking for, how easy is it to avoid, I don't think that broadcasting really is appreciably different than media that are regulated in a very, very different fashion.
About the seven dirty words case, the Pacifica case, of course, that standard of indecency that the FCC originated was then the standard that Congress tried to use in the first Communications Decency Act, banning indecent speech from the Internet. And an example that was given of speech that would publications online that would therefore be banned was, in fact, the text of the Seven Dirty Words monologue, which appeared as an appendix to the decision of the Supreme Court. So it's in every U.S. report. It's in every law library, and it's all over the web, of course. It's part of the Supreme Court's decision. And in one of the ironies of the way these things progress, the same justice who wrote that Pacifica decision, Stevens, then 20 years later, wrote the Communications Decency Act decision striking down this law and pointing to the Carlin monologue as an example of valuable social parity that would be banned by this law.
I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. We're talking about the innocence of children and indecency and trying to reconcile the two in a free society. And to do that, we have Harvey Silverglate, founder of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education and author of The Shadow University, with Marjorie Hines of the National Coalition Against Censorship, author of the book Not in Front of the Children, and with Dean Ronald Cass of the Boston University School of Law. What about censorship in other areas? It seems that we're trying to protect children in, for example, school curricula. Evolution, the famous case of the Kansas School Board that ruled out that the teaching of evolution, which was subsequently, I think, overturned by another school board. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, that sort of demonstrates the way in which education in this country has been politicized, because you have local and state school boards, and depending on elections or the vocal aggressiveness of a particular group that's very interested, they can really get changes in the curriculum, so that instead of education being something decided by educators, it tends to become an item in the culture wars with kids caught in the crossfire, really, and it's not to the advantage of the kids to have their education
politicized. Well, now you're saying that, but what about community standards, Dean? That's always been an argument for...
Well, there is a real argument for having individual communities make decisions about what happens in their community. That's a different argument, though, than the question of whether we actually want government at any level making decisions about what kids are exposed to, having government make the decision about what they see and don't see. I think Marjorie's point is we have that happen all the time in education. We have it all the time in the curriculum. We worry about it in the few cases that pop into public view. We worry about it when a book is taken out of the library, but we don't worry about the first selection of putting the books in the library. We worry about it when a school board says, here's a way you can't teach a subject, but we don't worry about it when the school board initially selects how you're going to teach the subject. One of the reasons why we have less discussion of this in America is because we do have a lot of private education alongside public education, so the people who tend to be most concerned have alternatives. But it's the same issue.
I think you're right. The focus on the kind of symbolic censorship initiatives distracts us from affirmative educational initiatives that, in fact, could address some of the very real anxieties you talk about. The parent concerned about porn on the internet. They don't want their kid to have a filter because they understand it blocks too much stuff and it's not reliable. But how do they educate their child to put this in context, because the child is eventually going to be confronted with the issue of pornography? It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. And good sexuality education, both at home and school, good media literacy education, which is far more advanced in other societies than in our own, could go a long way, I think, toward alleviating those parental anxieties and also really educating kids to make good decisions and make judgments about what they see.
I think that there are two levels, though, and I hate to sound like a broken record, but there's almost universal opposition to having children, young children, exposed to sexually oriented materials. Almost universal. I know I dissent from it, but I'm not the universe. The universe on the other side. Then there's a second level. The second level are political, religious, and cultural issues. And that varies from town to town, from community to community. Some communities you would find they want to teach Darwin, and some they'd say they want, some communities want to teach creationism. And there are these kinds of battles, which is they're political and religious. There is no uniformity around the country with respect to where the majorities are on these teaching issues. And they're battled out in every little hamlet in the country. And I think it's very good that happens, rather than have some national standard, some national dictator saying, you shall teach this and nothing else. Ultimately, it's better for liberty, even if within an individual town, there are some people who really want to stifle the children's exposure to, for example, Darwinian thought.
Well, we will eventually have the testing authority tell us all what it is we're going to be teaching. But I don't think
there is a national testing authority, and hopefully we can avoid that.
I don't think there is a way to have a decision made on what should be taught to children when you say, you know, there's good sexual education, there's good education. It's always going to be the same problem of identifying good as the problem of identifying bad. If you've got the government doing the identification, you've got an issue that's inevitably going to be posed whether you put it on one side of the coin or the other.
You raised an issue that's worth following up, though, and that is the input issue. There was a time when the basic curriculum of the Western civilization was based on a certain body of literature, a certain number of philosophers, a certain number of poets and playwrights, and then that all became called into question about 10 or 15 years ago, and now we have, you know, whole new fields of study, gender studies, feminist
right.
studies.
But I don't think, I disagree with Dean Kass that all of these educational decisions are totally subjective and relative. In the area of sexuality education in particular, and I sort of late in the process of doing the book, I realized I had to do a chapter on sexuality education because I discovered what a lot of people don't know is the federal government is now very heavily funding and pushing what they call abstinence education, by which they really mean preaching abstinence only until marriage as the only acceptable form of sexual activity. And in this country, marriage is not until mid-20s on the average. So it's unrealistic. It's totally unrealistic. It's ideologically driven. And we know from lots of studies, we know from sexuality educators who are familiar with this field and who've looked at comprehensive sexuality education programs starting at a young age with age-appropriate sexually oriented information, that good, solid, comprehensive information which talks about masturbation, that's a big no-no here still, talks about sexual orientation and gives kids at the right time information about birth control and safer sex and how to protect themselves before puberty. And it's clear from studies that none of that comprehensive education, much of which is banned by this abstinence pedagogy, that none of that contributes in the least to kids being encouraged to have sex any earlier. On the contrary, they have the information, they make better decisions. We know that. And yet this country is going backwards at a very alarming rate in the very important area of sex education.
You know, I think that they really understand. They're not stupid, these people. They understand that children masturbate. They just don't want to hear about it. And it's a sort of a willful blindness. If they don't talk about it and don't hear about it, they can at least pretend it's not going on. And it's a very odd way of educating children.
Well, I think it's more than that, though, and I don't think you can specify certain types of curriculum designs without getting to what it is you want to accomplish first. You need to specify the values before you can specify the means.
Well, there's a fairness aspect to all this.
There was a meta study that was just the results of which were just announced last week, to the effect that in context, the kind of education that you were talking about actually delays sexual activity on the part of the teenager. That if there has been no activity up to that point, then this kind of education creates a thought process in which it's delayed in a number of cases and certainly practiced safely in a lot more cases. So these decisions have very real impacts on the lives of the next generation.
Well, that's what I was getting at before. The idea that if you don't talk about sex, the young kids are not going to do it, is one of the great delusions that adults take comfort in, but it's really not true. They also don't remember back to their own youth. That's one of the problems.
Memory edits.
That's not a problem. That's a benefit.
Another interesting study, though, reminds me of Justice Douglas dissenting from one of these harm-to-minors censorship cases in the 60s and saying, you know, if you're going to start censoring because you don't trust juveniles, then you really have to also apply it to adults because most of the juvenile delinquents I know are over 50 years of age. But, you know, there was a study a couple of years ago by the Kaiser Family Foundation that found more than 80% of American parents do want their kids to get comprehensive sexuality education, although I think masturbation may have not been mentioned. A number of other issues that are excluded by this abstinence curriculum were mentioned as things parents specifically want their kids to get instructed
about. A lot of parents are uncomfortable with instructing their children. A lot of children are uncomfortable with hearing their parents. I mean, my father, I think we had one conversation about it. The man was in such pain.
And that was last year. Very difficult conversation. One of my friends always said he wanted his sons to learn about it on the street the way he had.
Your parents were ahead of mine. I never got the conversation. All I got was a little sanitary napkin insert one day when I was around 13, sort of left in my room. That was it.
Well, it's the world of ideas as well as memories. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Our guests are Marjorie Hines, Harvey Silverglate, and Ron Cass, and we're talking about the tension between indecency, the innocence of children, and how we can balance the two and still have an open and honest society. Is this discussion really mainly about sex?
Well, there are certain other things government...
Aren't all conversations?
There are certain other things government bans. For example, the government does control the exposure of children to advertisements for liquor and tobacco, and presumably in the name of their health. But for the most part, the laws, the criminal laws, seek to limit children's access to sexual information and material, and it's just part of our long history as a kind of prudish society, going back, especially in Massachusetts, going back to the Puritans.
What about this whole violence thing, though? I noted one study was that a British study, the absence of parental violence, there's no significant relationship between offending on the part of a juvenile and a preference for violent films.
Well, you can find studies that point in all different directions, and you're right that violence, media violence, is a big issue, and a lot of our political leaders are, predictably, every few months, there'll be another occasion for bashing Hollywood.
A Columbine massacre
bashing
Hollywood, terrible.
Without any specificity as to what is meant by violent content, and of course, violent content is so pervasive in all media and always has been, and in literature and art and news and sports, that anybody has ever tried to draft a law, and a great many efforts have been made, they stumble over how to define what it is they think is bad or harmful violence. Look at the social science literature, which has been so widely claimed to have proof, to have established proof of a causal connection between violent entertainment, never defined, and antisocial conduct. Also, very different definitions. And the fact is, it's just not there. It is a real case of Emperor's New Clothes when you look at the experiments that are done, the ways in which experimenters who are vested in this particular theory, which is a very simplistic way of looking at how entertainment and information is processed by different people, when you look at the way they try to manipulate results.
Oh, wait a minute. What about the studies that show youngsters playing or viewing violently and then playing, and they're more likely to hit other little kids? I mean, these are supposed to have been done by pediatricians.
I would like at this point to just interject the following observation. I accept the notion, even though I understand and I agree with the studies that Marjorie's pointing to, I accept the notion that speech has consequences. I accept the notion that people sometimes do things which they read about or see on the movie screen, that speech gives people ideas. It is, after all, why we protect it. It's why there's a First Amendment. If speech were irrelevant to conduct, then we wouldn't be protecting speech because it wouldn't be important enough. So I accept that. The question I raise, and which is raised in Marjorie's book, is whether or not we are going to teach children that violence is bad by keeping from them information about the real world, or whether we're going to expose them to the real world and then try to give them an education that allows them to sort out the good from the bad in their own way. And it seems to me if you've got a free society, only the latter paradigm works. So I don't like predicating First Amendment argument, for example, to protect the right of movies to depict violence. I don't like arguing that, well, it doesn't really cause violence in children.
That's not what I said.
I know that. But you see, the argument easily gets transmogrified into we should have a rating system for movie that includes violence because violence in the screen causes violence in the kids. Mm-hmm. And I say, even if that were true, it seems to me it's not a good argument for censorship.
Well, before we get to the question of whether censorship is a good idea, a bad idea, availing, not availing, I'm not sure that I should let pass so quickly, Harvey, the notion that what we're exposing people to is the real world. When you see, you know, I don't think that rap music lyrics describe anything I would say is the real world or much of what we're talking about, good or bad, that we see on the internet or over the media or on broadcasting really is the real world. Part of the problem that we have when dealing with children is that most of us have children who are thoroughly insulated from what we would describe as the real world, so that there's a bigger impact that's likely from exposure to things that they get with music, with entertainment, with other sources. One of the problems that gives us then is if we worry about that, what do we do? If we don't trust the government to tell us what the kids should and shouldn't see or what we shouldn't see, what is it we do?
Well, we educate.
And parents decide how to do that for their own children.
Yeah, the point I was making is, yes, of course, the media have lots of effects. And as Harvey says, some deranged people may imitate some crazy thing they see on the screen. Lots of others will use violent entertainment for relaxation, a cathartic effect. Troubled kids who listen to hard, heavy metal music, really for its cathartic and relaxing effect. So there are lots of effects. And you can't generalize about what they are and whether any particular work of expression will have adverse or not.
Well, let's look at the clock.
The point is, yes, there are effects, and if we're concerned about them, let's try to figure out educational ways to address those concerns.
But what about a Clockwork Orange, where the...
You mean the violence in Clockwork Orange?
Not just the violence. I mean the premise. The premise was a fascinating one, that using behavioral therapy by showing what Alex, the miscreant, had done so viciously over and over and over, he became so sickened by it that even the thought of it made him ill. And the people that felt that this was wrong to shape a person's mind in that way, that each individual had a right to his own mind, then deprogrammed him, and he became the monster that he was before. I mean, there's an argument there that these kinds of things can have an effect.
As a free society, the idea of doing thought control and thought reform is anathema to us. And the price we pay in terms of liberty and decency, even if, you know, maybe we can program three or four miscreants, the price that we pay as a society for depriving an entire culture of the freedom to be whom you are, it seems to me, is a huge price, not worth it.
Okay, well, that's the argument that they made. On the other hand, Alex was not somebody you'd want to run into.
That is an extremely troubling, disturbing movie. And
yes.
The book is even better.
Exactly. I know. The use of the Russian words
It triggers all kinds of interesting thoughts about the relationship between culture and individuality. And Alex also loves Beethoven. He loves classical music, and yet he is this monster. But I think it's probably quite unlikely that too many viewers of Clockwork Orange went out and imitated
horrendous
acts.
I just wanted to discuss this. I think
so
we're doing
it. So it has a very strong effect on people, all the more reason to talk about it.
When you talk about thought control, I think that Harvey's earlier point, that we worry about speech protection because it's effective, we are engaged in thought control. We're engaged in it over and over and over again. We're not engaged in it in the sort of mechanical programming way. We're engaged in it in what it is we do teach, what it is we teach in the schools, what sort of messages we send. We tell people the values of patriotism. We tell people the values of saving, the values of working hard. We tell people a lot of things precisely because we do want to control what they think, and we do want to control or shape what they think, and we want to shape what they do. There are better and worse activities in terms of how it affects society, in terms of how it affects others. And a lot of our own activity is directed to just that end.
I would make a distinction between shape and control. For obvious reasons, I'm more comfortable with shape. And public education is an interesting paradoxical situation because, yes, we do shape and indoctrinate and try to inculcate values, but we also should recognize, as the Supreme Court used to do when I went to law school, that the public school is not a closed-circuit system. It's not Plato's
shape
Republic.
Is just a soft word for control.
I disagree.
Okay. I want to find out how you, all of you, Harvey Silverglate, Marjorie Hines, Dean Cass, think cultural differences, especially today, fit into all of this. But first, I just want to say that this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. We're talking about indecency and the innocence of youth. And let me open that up for general discussion. How do you think cultural differences in our increasingly multicultural society fit into this?
Well, I'll take a crack at that. I don't think that we are as different now as we were before. It is true that we have many more ethnic groups, we have many more skin colors, we have many more religions than we used to have. But it's interesting how after a while, when a family or a group has been in this country for a while, they tend to come to a kind of national ethic, a national belief system, including, incidentally, in the value of liberty. It's very interesting that people who come from some of the harshest authoritarian and totalitarian countries, they come here and they're sounding off almost from the start and not willing to be controlled. And so there is a kind of natural ethos that prevails in this country, and groups do tend to there is a certain collective identity as free American citizens. I find it actually quite heartening as a civil libertarian. I find it very heartening because it tells me that even people who come from cultures which don't value freedom over there. There was a piece actually on NPR a few weeks ago that I heard was quite interesting. It was one of your reporters was in a cafe in New York that served Indians and Pakistanis who got along quite well. They argued some politics, but they got along quite well. They were the knives didn't come out as soon as they were together in the cafe. And these are people who just recently came over from India and Pakistan, and just a few years before, they were at each other's throats, ready to kill each other. They come to New York, and they're sitting in the same cafe enjoying coffee and political debate with each other. There is something about this country that does that, and we don't want to ruin that.
I thought it was a civilizing effect of coffee.
No, they have coffee over there, believe it or not, and it's sometimes
better.
Stronger and better than the coffee,
coffee
in New York.
Carvey is certainly right that the notion of liberty is a very powerful and very important notion, and it has a very American quality to it the way we use it here. There's almost no argument that is made in America where one side or another doesn't deploy a notion of liberty in defense of its own ideal. We have very different particulars in the notion of liberty, and we have different times when we deploy the arguments. You'll find people who are political adversaries, each will employ it. They'll just employ it to different ends.
Well, mainly when they're someone's telling them to shut up is when they pull it out. That's true.
Well, okay, but there's a difference between liberty and license. It's figuring out what it is that has us puzzled from time to time.
Yeah. Liberty is what I want to do. License is what you're letting Harvey do.
Marjorie?
I do have a chapter in the book on cultural differences, and it refers primarily to comparisons I make with harm to minors-based censorship in Europe. And one of the anecdotes that I tell is Oxford University was commissioned by the European Parliament to do a study of whether they should copy America and have a V-chip requirement throughout the nations of the European Union. And one thing that Oxford University team discovered in the course of preparing this 500-page report was that you couldn't have a V-chip because there are too many cultural differences. There are too many different standards throughout the nations of the European Union about what kids shouldn't see. And they give as the primary example, of course, is different attitudes towards sex, where Britain is the most like the United States, although not quite as puritanical. Most of the Puritans came over here. But in other countries, sexual content is not a concern, and it is not considered that sexual content is harmful to or inappropriate for, is really the more appropriate term, minors. So that's one example of cultural differences. In this country, I think the major cultural difference, and there, I think it's really quite a serious rift, is between a large proportion, but not a majority, of people who believe that information should be controlled, not only for kids but for everybody, but kids become the easy rhetorical hook on which to make the censorship argument, and those and who therefore would not be interested in some of the proposals that we should think more seriously about media literacy, train kids in critical thinking, train kids to go through a thought process by which they can discriminate between good and bad values in the entertainment and so forth. And then there is another cultural sector in this country, which I think is a majority of people who would be in favor of more free and open discourse and giving kids an education that enabled them to make value judgments and think and become more responsible citizens.
I would quickly say that we have a lot of people who want to censor what everyone sees and hears, and they use kids as the easy vehicle. There are a lot of people who are really concerned about children. They are really focused on protecting children against what they see as harmful influences.
I agree. And I
think very few people want to censor much more generally. I think that's a real tiny part
of
the population.
They may be tiny, but they have a lot of voice in Congress at this point.
I don't think those people do. The people I see in Congress, Marjorie, are people who are concerned. You know, John McCain is authoring a bill to protect children from harm from the Internet. There are a lot of people who care about liberty and
an example of rhetoric used to, I think, a cynical end, because protect and harm are two big hot-button words, but that does not. McCain has been the proponent of bills mandating Internet filtering in schools and libraries for years, and that legislation finally did pass. Now, you may call it child protection, but as we know from some of the examples we gave, and there are many, many more, it is a very, very crude tool with some significant negatives
to it. At the risk of sounding like a cynic, which I'm not, I do have some special thoughts about people who, for example, want to keep harmful sexual information from children for their protection, but are opposed to things like feeding them lunch at school. It sort of reminds me of Barney Frank's famous dictum that there are some people who believe that life begins at conception but ends at birth.
On that note, let me just say that Harvey Silverglate, Ron Cass, and Marjorie Hines are my guests on Boston University's World of Ideas. We're on very short time now, and I would like to ask each of you, what do we do? What do we do?
I think the what do we do is a common ground for all of us, which is education. It's the one thing we can agree can be done in a way that will help people without enormous costs in terms of trying to decide who gets access to what. It's the one thing that the commission that Congress set up to look at this said would be effective at trying to address problems of speech over the Internet. And I think that at the end of the day, while we may differ about what the educational message is, it's the one route that all of us are going to say is open and appropriate.
Marjorie Hines?
Okay, this is really shameless. What we should do is, first of all, we should read the book, not in front of the children. It's got a lot of information, and it's really designed as a resource for policymakers and educators, librarians, parents, and kids, because kids should be heard from on this issue, too. Hopefully, to be able to use that information to have more thoughtful conversation about what the best ways are to deal with very real anxieties about entertainment.
How did you deal with it in your own life?
I have two grown kids whom I did not censor. And I think this is a fairly common experience. Kids censor themselves. Young kids tend to be grossed out by anything sexually explicit. They don't really want to know any very detailed explanations. Often, if they happen upon something on the Internet that is sexually explicit and they find it disturbing, they will simply move on. So I didn't censor my kids, except I didn't let them stay in front of the television set too long.
Harvey?
I think we have to give children the tools to navigate what is an often dangerous and sometimes ugly world. And that can't be done by giving them illusions that certain things don't exist when we all know they do exist. And so I think that we have to just help open their eyes and give them some tools to navigate the world.
But I want to just ask one final question, and that is the first known instance of the law being applied to this kind of conduct is Rex versus Sedley back in 1728, in which the fellow was convicted of destruction of morality in general for performing an offense of a public nature. Are we ever going to see that sort of thing enforced in our time?
Well, now that morality has been destroyed, we don't need to worry about that.
As we know from the FCC's latest foray into indecency enforcement, this story continues to go on.
Well, I just don't think that we are ever going to successfully enforce morality. We should stick to protecting people from real physical harm and not from harm to their brains.
Thank you, Harvey Silverglate, Marjorie Hines, Ronald Cass.
You've been listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight, Indecency, Censorship, and the Innocence of Youth, with Marjorie Hines, author of Not in Front of the Children, the book whose subtitle gave us the title of our program. Ms. Hines is director of the Free Expression Policy Project of the National Coalition Against Censorship. And with Dean Ron Cass of the Boston University School of Law, as well as Harvey Silverglate, attorney and co-author of The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on the Nation's Campuses. Join us again next week. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. Visit our website at wbur.org and wrni.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Keith Infantino, Vince Fairchild, and Bob Zalisk. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. Stay tuned. Just ahead, it's BBC Assignment, and then at 10:30,